Hello. Can you all hear me okay? Let me try that again. How's that? Thanks for coming today. My name is Paul Huggins. I'm an attorney at Wilson Sonsini Goodrich Rosati, and we have a based out in California law firm, have offices in the U.S., including Austin, and specialize in representing high-tech companies, from small companies, startups, to large corporations. And today we're here to talk about the life cycle of an idea. And my personal background is currently I'm an attorney doing tech transactions work. So that's helping companies like David's and Ben's do agreements for their commercialization of their technology, and then also work on financing and merger transactions. And so I just wanted to introduce myself, and then we can move on into the presentation. The two main points that I want to that we want to address today and get these guys to weigh in on are pretty simple. The first is, when we have an idea, when an entrepreneur has an idea, or a company has an idea, or an employee or a consultant, you know, who owns that idea and who has an interest in it? And then the second point is to address what the rights are in the idea, and you know, things flow from there. So again, you know, who owns the idea at its birth, and then what are the types of legal protection for an idea under the various doctrines of law? And on the panel today, we have a number of folks. We have, I guess you can see the name tags, but Matt Esper here is general counsel at NCSoft, which is a gaming company. I'll let each of these guys introduce themselves, but we've got Matt, and David Altunian is with iTagit Inc. After David is Wade Monroe, who's a consultant and investor with the Eyes of Texas Partners, and Ben Brook, who's with Envato. And I've had the pleasure of working with each of these guys. So why don't I hand it over to them, and you guys tell a little bit more about what you do and about your perspective.
Sure. As Paul said, my name's Matt Esper. I am the general counsel of NCSoft Corporation. We're an online, massively multiplayer online role-playing game based in Seoul, Korea, and I mainly handle North American and European matters for our corporation. My background's very similar to Paul's. I started off at Wilson Sonsini in Silicon Valley, worked there for 2 years, and then in 1999, moved down here to Austin to open up the office here. In 2004, I got the itch to actually go to a company and help grow an industry rather than sit on the outside looking in, as we do as outside counsel, and jump to NCSoft at that time. I'll hand it off here in a moment, but I think one of the benefits, hopefully for all of you listening to this panel, is you'll get a wide variety of views from attorneys to entrepreneurs to an investor, and hopefully that'll help everybody out, and we'll have a question and answer session at the end for you.
Thanks. My name is, can you hear me all right here? My name is Dave Altunian. I'm the CEO of iTagit. I've been doing new business startups for about 20 years. Before I started my first entrepreneurial experience, I was with corporations doing new business development. So I've actually seen both sides of the equation. I've done both new divisions inside large corporations. And then in 2001, I spun out and started a company in town here called Motion Computing with a group of my friends. And then this is my second startup. So I've got kind of an interesting perspective, having been on both sides. A little bit about iTagit. iTagit is a online destination for people to organize and showcase and monetize things that they own that they care about, like art and antiques. And it's a little bit of old school asset management tied to social networking, and very different from hardware we've done before, with its own unique set of intellectual property issues.
Speaking of old school, here I am. I spent about 25 years in the software business, retired from Trilogy Software in 1998. About a year later, I started getting involved in some investing, and I guess I'm called an angel investor now. And over the past 8 years, I've done about eight deals that are complete in terms of either selling the companies or liquidating, and currently invested in about four companies. I'm a partner at the Eyes of Texas Partners, which is a band of angels. We have about 15 partners and look at a number of deals each month and make investments. Right now, I've found the last 12, 14 months been very, very active. Probably seen more deals, better deals than I had seen the last 4 or 5 years. So it's even though the economy may be slowing down, it hasn't quite hit the entrepreneurs yet, and which I think is great to see these opportunities. Thank you.
Thanks. My name is Ben Brook. I'm the CEO of a company here in Austin called Envato. Envato is my fourth startup. When I was talking to Paul about this concept and this panel and whatnot, it got me excited because with my background is I've seen the evolution of an idea on the business side of things, of the small business that has grown, but I've also seen it as an independent. So I've invented products. I've considered licensing those over. I've sold patents. I've done those sort of things. So, as we're looking at the questions and answers here, I kind of look at it from both sides. I see how important it is for us to, you know, as a company to protect our ideas and what's developed in that company. But then as an entrepreneur and inventor, you know, I know how important it is that, you know, I'm creating that paper trail and I'm able to, you know, own those, proprietary rights and ideas that I'm developing as well.
Thanks, guys. So, I think one of the great things about this panel is that we have people with such different backgrounds. And, you know, as we were kind of overlaying folks' backgrounds with the life cycle of an idea, whether it be how do I get the idea into a company if I'm an entrepreneur, how do I, you know, I'm at a company and I have idea, or how do you make things, you know, packaged the right way for investors, or from, you know, the general counsel's point of view, if you're acquiring a company, looking at a company, you've got people with different perspectives. And so thanks guys for being here. So the first idea that I want to open up the panel for discussion on is, I'll run through a little bit, but you know, you got the entrepreneur or the person with an idea, the light bulb goes off, and you know, at that moment, who has rights in the idea? We've got different types of folks. We have employees, consultants. There might be a researcher at a university, you know, either part-time or full-time, or it might be someone out on their own. And just to run real quickly through, depending on kind of what your status is and what your affiliation is, different entities or different stakeholders might have an interest in your idea at the time you actually have it. So if you're an employee, whether or not you signed an inventions assignment agreement, which lots of technology companies have their employees sign, there might be some common law rights that the employer has, depending on kind of the scope of the idea related to the scope of the company and the duties and so forth, whether you're using company resources. On top of that, obviously, there's the agreements themselves. Consultants, the law is a little bit different, but again, oftentimes there's an agreement. And so depending on what you're doing and how it relates to what you've been engaged to do, that's a factor. The university affiliation is an interesting one. I don't know if it's one that folks often think about, but as an attorney advising companies who are maybe investors or companies buying companies, it's something that we look at from time to time, where if you're a researcher and you're, every university has its own policy as to, you know, what claim that the university has on something that the professors or the researchers do. And so those policies are real important to look at, and it might not be something that people realize. And then, the entrepreneur who has no strings attached at the moment, there's, you know, in terms of them owning it, that's probably their best case, but it's not always a done deal. There might sometimes be, for instance, an assignment agreement with the former employer that kind of claws into the future after you've left. So it's different things. Different things like that, come into play. And I guess what I'd like to do now is open it up to you guys, to the panel. And ask you to talk a little about what, I guess we have the different perspectives, but from David and Ben's perspective, you know, having been, you know, folks that have been at different companies at different times, I'm just wondering, you know, in terms of the process, how do you go about kind of securing your ownership for that next venture? What's the thought process?
Okay, so, you know, as a an independent inventor, entrepreneur, somebody that's come up with concepts, the first thing that I always do is I think of resources, and I think of, you know, whose dime am I on? So if I if I'm working for someone, if I'm doing consulting work or whatnot, I always immediately approach those people and let them know, hey, I've come up with a concept. I explain to them how it's outside of the scope of what they're doing. I have developed concepts as a contractor that I understand that I don't own. That's what they're paying me to do. But if I do see that there's going to be that, you know, there's a differentiation there, which has happened several times, I do approach them. And when I say I approach them in writing. I try to create that trail. I think that's it's very, very important to make sure that it's, you know, as black and white as I can make it, that, you know, this isn't being done, you know, for this company, and it isn't being done with their resources. So, you know, I go as far as having a separate bank account and everything set up. Any travel that I might do for that other concept is always going to be done, you know, out of my own accounts and not in any way, shape, or form associated with the group that I'm working with. Now, you know, as an employer and the companies that I've started, you know, it's really, really important. And I realized that just in the last 2 months, how important it is that we own the rights to, you know, all the technologies and innovations within that company. One of the things that, you know, I would want to encourage anybody that's starting a company, and, you know, Wade could probably talk to it a lot better than I can now, but, you know, when I was working with investors, I mean, that was one of the first things they wanted to know is say, okay, we're going to invest in your company, but who owns what you have? Fortunately, with Envato, we were able to, you know, get together with Paul and whatnot. We got real good counsel, and so we set up the EPIAs and the agreements right up front with every contractor and employee that came on board with us. And I'm going to be honest with you, when, you know, when I'm starting a company, it seems like there's, you know, so many other things going on, and, you know, there's so many other balls in the air that sometimes those are the type of things that, you know, maybe I've been a little bit guilty of overlooking. But, you know, as I've just closed out this recent round of financing with the larger venture group, I realized that, hey, you know, it's real important to have your ducks in a row there, and it's important to be able to access that information when you need it.
So I started both these companies out of different circumstances. I started Motion with my group of friends 6 months after I left Dell, and four of my co-founders were also ex-Dell executives. So the first thing we had to deal with at Dell was, you know, as we started Motion, was dealing with the Dell IP, and I'm going to tell you a risk that we learned from this one. And the second one, I went back and got my MBA from Kellogg, and this came out of a project at school. So I had kind of the university experience, which was very, very different. The thing I learned, I think, from both of those is, and I think is a trap most people fall into, is that they believe that by asking their executive or the dean, and they say, yeah, that's a great idea, that's permission to take the IP. And there's two problems that happen. One is no one's interested in your idea until it starts to become successful, because they get so many people saying, I have a great idea, that it's like, yeah, go for it. When you start to get traction is when the corporate arm actually dives in and says, wait a second, I don't care what that executive may not even be there anymore. So same thing with the school side. You know, it's not enough just to have your professor or your dean say, that's a great idea, let me know how I can help. That is not a release of IP. And so the thing that we learned very early on was, fortunately, we had some of those challenges when we were still young, was to get close to the intellectual property departments with the sponsorship of whoever you're working with and make sure, as Ben said, document it early. Because I think, you know, again, the problem you're going to have isn't when you have the idea. The problem you're going to have is when you're successful. So that was the first learning. The second thing I would say is that I have a very, you know, I learned this on the corporate side. I have a strong belief that a good IP attorney is important very early on, not for the prosecution or protection, but to get the processes set up right, so that you're documenting it correctly. It's very hard to go back later and recreate the things you need to protect your intellectual property. And while it sounds expensive and challenging, it really isn't. If you engage an IP lawyer early enough, I think you find it saves you money in the long run because you're not covering tracks, you're actually building tracks. So that would be my learnings I got out of that.
Maybe, Wade, this would be a good time for you to chime in just from the other side of the coin. And I'm interested, I've had occasion to work with Wade on actually not the investment side of things, but on companies where he it's already been an investor and then that company ended up being sold, you know, bought by a larger company. So, you know, in terms of risk around ownership of IP, I wonder if you could just touch on, you know, both from the investor side, but also seeing the you know, the company on the exit side of things, how those things sometimes come into play.
Sure, I'd be happy to. First, on the first part of when I go and look at a company that we're considering investing in, I'll immediately do three things early on. Number one, ask them for the source of their idea. Where did it come from? Number one, you can learn a lot about the founder himself or herself by engaging, and most of them love to talk about it. And many people will come up with these ideas while they're an employee of another company. And if they have a solution that is, you know, very related to their prior employment, then that's a little bit of a red flag. You better take a close look. The second thing I take a look at is early on is to be sure that they have signed the developers and other people in their company have signed employee proprietary agreements, assigning their rights to the product over to the company. And then finally, what I look at the initial customer contracts they will have. And many times in the zeal of a new company to start selling a product and selling their first product, they will sign away many, many rights that the customers, a sophisticated customer, will ask for. And what can happen is that you can suddenly realize you've given away either a major piece of your software or some significant rights to it, or you may have even created a competitor without getting the good, strong IP attorney up front. As far as exiting, the very first thing that a buyer will go look at is the ownership issue, and will go back to the very beginning of the company. Sometimes these companies are a couple years old, but more likely they're 5, 6, 7 years old, and sometimes that data is not even available, which creates some other problems. And in many times, they can use it as a, it can be a real thing or it can be a negotiating thing and significantly reduce the value of what you're trying to sell the company for. To me, when you startups, you know, it's easy to sit up here and talk about a lot of these things and what you should do, knowing that the startups, when they get going, have a lot of different things coming at them all at once. Very easy to get overwhelmed and push some of these things aside. And what I try to advise the startups to do is you got to reduce these number of problems, issues coming at you. And there are some that are just easy decisions. And one of those, I think, really easy decisions is to protect your IP. Now, it's easy to make the decision. It may be difficult to implement because you, even though it's easy, you do need to understand what you're dealing with. Interview attorneys, select one, be prepared to pay some money out to protect your IP. But once you're done, you're done. And you can, you know, set up the proper controls within your business to be sure this continues. And then you can go, and then you can address some of your other issues that are not so easy, that are not such easy decisions. And finally, I joined a software company about 15 years ago as their CFO. It's a public company. It's probably about $150 million in revenue. I go there. I'm there a week, and I have somebody in the lobby who would like to see me. And it turns out to be a federal marshal. And I said, "Oops!" And he basically issues me a document that says an injunction has been filed against one of your products. And by the way, our customers are large banks, and we were selling a system software that works in the, you know, in the data processing room and helps them back up and restore their computers. And by the way, we have also issued cease and desist orders to these customers. And which are some major banks in the Midwest, and I said fine. So we take that and we panic and run around and discover that later that, by golly, we are violating somebody else's patent and also their copyright. They had recently acquired a company a few months before, and I thought they had done a very good job of their due diligence, checking ownership, all these things. And what we discovered was a fairly low-level developer had copied line by line their exact code for a major piece of this product that we bought and implemented. So we had to go out and go see our customers, sit down and spend some time with the software companies that was accusing us. It took us about two nights, all night, till we finally negotiated a license where we could use their product, pay a nice, fat, healthy royalty. But we did get it settled and allowed our customers to keep operating because they were shut down. So once again, the earlier you can get somebody in who really knows what they're doing, and the better off you'll be from the day one. And I encourage the startups early on when they're putting their plan together and they're trying to figure out how much resources they need, that their base technology is not complete until you have protected it, either with a patent if possible, certainly with other means of protections that are perhaps maybe less costly. But do it up front, do it early, and then hold your breath, because if you're successful, somebody's going to come after you. And when that happens, you'll need all the protection you possibly can have.
Matt, I wonder from your point of view, I know your company recently was involved where you acquired a company, so I wonder if you could talk about that process a little bit, but also about your particular role among all of us up here about being kind of the in-house counsel and being kind of, how often is it that folks come to you, or how often is it that you are in a position to have to kind of filter through these things and sort through ideas about ownership and so forth?
Sure. First, I want to thank David for saying something nice about lawyers. It's so rarely the case that happens. As an in-house counsel, my view, at least from an acquisition standpoint, is very similar to Wade's. When I go in and look at a company, a potential target, first thing we're going to look at is to make sure every employee has signed a proprietary information and invention assignment agreement. I won't bore you with too much detail, but that basically says you'll protect the company's confidential information. And if during your employment you come up with an idea that is within the company's realm of business, then it is going to be the company's intellectual property. We also make sure that consultants have been signed up. This is a real trap for a lot of startups and young companies. They will go out and engage consultants to do work. And unlike employees in general, without a contract in place, the contractor will continue to own the intellectual property rights in their creation on behalf of the company. So just be very careful when you do that in the future. I also involve our IT staff quite heavily to go through the code to the extent they can and vet out any issues. We oftentimes come across open source, and I don't want to get down into that quagmire too much, but to the extent there are open source issues, you want to understand what licenses the code was obtained under and what complications, if any, that's going to cause you in the long run. The second question I think Paul asked was an employee coming to me with an idea that they've we'll assume created on their own time outside of their working hours, using their own resources, their own computer, not company resources, because that's when you as an inventor or an entrepreneur are going to have a hard time with somebody like me, because I'll take a draconian view and tell you it's mine, and by mine I mean our company's. But what we'll want to do is, or if what you'll want to do as an entrepreneur in that case is, as Ben was saying, hit the issue head on and early, get documentation out there fast, talk to the in-house counsel if you need to make sure you guys are all on the same page. Fortunately, with my company, what we tend to do is we encourage people to be creative, because that's what our industry is about, and we hope to eventually fund that project internally and allow you to set up a development team in-house. And last point I'll touch on is encourage your employee base to be creative. And you can do this through various means. For example, you can come up with a patent invention program where you'll award the employee some cash or stock options in your company if they disclose their idea to you. It looks like it'll serve your company well and your customer base, and then eventually you'll have a patent issue. So those are just some issues to think about.
Great. Thanks, guys. That's actually a really good segue into the second half of our presentation or the discussion. But before I do that, so it looks like we're about halfway through the hour. So, you know, if I said there's a mic there, people can just raise their hand. If you have questions along the way, you want to stop us, please do. But we'll also try and save a little time at the end for any questions that folks have. Kind of the second point that we want to talk about, you know, now we talked about kind of the idea of who has ownership. Oh, looks, I said it, and there we go. Why don't you?
So some of these ideas sound good if you are a company with funding or some bank account, right? Like, I don't guess anybody here probably is that person developing an app on the side and has that kind of money to even engage in a lawyer, probably. So what do you guys see any future for cheapo solutions for people coming up with ideas so they can be somewhat protected? I mean, it's obviously a trade-off, right? We're not getting patents, and trademark is, I just spent $3,000 on a trademark and I want to slip my wrists.
So let me jump on that, because I'm actually a cheapo too. And I didn't spend a lot of money early on patents. The way I view it is you go find an IP attorney and you sell them on your idea like you sell a VC, and you explain, I have no cash, but I think this will be a viable business. And both times I got IP attorneys to sign up. In some cases, they'll defer their billing. Some cases, they'll lower their rates. But most IP attorneys, because they're dealing with inventors, especially, things are a little harder when you're dealing with a large law practice. But there's a lot of IP attorneys that understand that inventors don't have a lot of cash, just a lot of good ideas. And I would really highly recommend, take your deck, find the IP attorneys, and pitch it like a VC. And your last slide is, I have no cash.
Yeah.
So that would be my suggestion.
Well, you know, I've done that exact thing. So I've been in the same exact boat that you're talking about, where, you know, I didn't have the money, have the resources, and I could talk more about patents all day long if you want. But as far as getting my ducks in a row, just go and pitch it the same way you would pitch it to, you know, if you're getting finance. And these attorneys, they hear it every day, and they know a good idea from a bad idea. They know if you're serious. And I'm curious to hear what Wade has to say, but you know, with Envato, I mean, we started out in my bedroom, and by me, when I brought on contractors and I was able to, get the guys over, you know, with Paul and everyone involved, and they set up that process. When I did get big enough where it was time for me to bring in financing, they looked at me a little bit different, like, you know what, not only is this a good idea, but this guy must have his head on his shoulders, because he knew that on day one he should be doing this. So, I mean, just find a way to do it, you know, get inventive.
The other thing, before you ask your question, the other thing is, you know, there's different ways to mitigate the risk. And one is to, you know, talk to attorneys, whatever. But the other is just to, if you're working somewhere else, pull out your, you know, your employment agreement, anything you have, pull out your, you know, corporate behavior policy or whatever the policies are, and read them as if you're, you know, Matt making the draconian claim later. So I was thinking of an example. My father-in-law used to work at Shell. And there's like a family joke that he has, when he was a kid, he had, when my wife was a kid, she and her brother were given a magnifying glass in the backyard and some popcorn kernels. And he had claimed to invented the solar popcorn machine. And I was thinking, you know, all right, Shell's an oil company, but it's an energy company. You know, obviously the connection between, you know, solar energy and everything, you know, that's a silly example, but, look at those policies and agreements from the perspective of, you know, wanting to make that like nth degree claim, and maybe a way to mitigate that risk is to go to your manager or whatever and say, and obviously this is a decision that folks have to make on their own, but, you know, be upfront with them and say, look, this really is different. I'm doing it on my own time. That's another approach to kind of getting security at some level.
Yeah. Let me just interrupt for one moment. And I know it is very hard for an entrepreneur to spend fees on attorneys, but I can assure you, when you do go out to look for venture financing, or you are trying to license your product to a larger corporation, it will cost you a significant amount of money to unwind any problems that were created early on. And to the extent that you can get your ducks in a row early, please do so. And once you get the form in place from your IP or outside counsel, it's very simple for you to manage and protect yourself.
Two things. I'd just like to ask you to talk about prior invention agreements for people who are moving, say, from a contract role to a full-time role. You know, you need to protect your inventions. Maybe you could talk about some aspects with regard to that. And then secondly, can you talk about, and I think I'm probably jumping the gun here, the difficulty or ease with which you can obtain software patents to protect your product or process when really all you've got is a first mover advantage? Thanks.
Sure. Matt, do you want to cover the idea about the prior inventions and how that comes up for if you know, the HR person comes into your office and says, look, this person's claiming all these inventions. How do you what does that mean to you?
Sure. We like most larger companies, have the proprietary information and invention assignment agreement. As part of that form, there's a last page for the new employee to disclose all his or her prior inventions. And I encourage you to do that. It's in your best interest, and it's in our best interest that we know these things up front. What we do in those instances is if you end up incorporating that idea or concept, whatever you own the proprietary rights in, into one of our products, we're going to get a license from you. It's a royalty-free license. It's very broad, as you can imagine, but definitely disclose those prior inventions to protect yourself. And so we know what you've done as well. It's in your best interest. And then just briefly on software patents, it's becoming more and more tough right now in the PTO to get patents on software products and business concepts. So I think you're going to see that landscape change quite a bit in the next 6 months or so. You'll also see, hopefully, a streamlining of the jurisdictions that are patent mills, like the Eastern District of Texas here, where you don't just set up shop and sue random companies in order to extract funds from them.
Yeah, I'm going to jump on that one too, because I think there's an interesting challenge that we look at today, which is the whole concept of Web 2.0 has a large component of mashups. And, you know, how do you deal with the IP issues in a mashup? Do you have to go back and do business process patents, or do you have to actually do some type of IP agreement? I think that area is totally untested, and it's going to be an interesting challenge in the next year or so.
Hi. I deal with IP, soft IP, internally as an in-house counsel for copyrights and trademarks. And one comment on, is it Tickle? Is it a company? What company? Anyway, the slitting your wrists with trademarks. There is a very easy, go to the U.S., you know, the USPTO has a website. You can search for trademarks there. But the idea is your idea starts with a name. Try to come up, it's hard to come up with a name that is, you know, arbitrary and capricious or something that's totally made up. Descriptive names will come up and bite you in the butt. But you can do a lot of research online just through that and educate yourself on copyrights and trademark. My question would be, though, within the life cycle of product development or within the life cycle of a launch, where does soft IP, in your mind, reside in importance? In my mind, it's go out and try to find a domain name out there for anything that's somewhat descriptive or describing your product, but you want to have the trademark rights in that name, and then trying to come up with a name that's made up, so like Zillow or Trulia or something like that was in the real estate space, is great. So can you just sort of comment on that? Because to me, that's some low-hanging fruit that people can use immediately to secure decent protection. And then the whole patent thing, I mean, that's a difficult concept.
Sure. It might be... we're about to talk about the different types of protection. And just for the purposes of giving everyone a background, just to move, it might be helpful to move through the different types of protection that you can get in ideas. And we can address that in connection with that. So we can differentiate the patent from the trademark to folks that might be just being introduced to those things. So I actually have trademark here highlighted because I don't intend to go into a lot of detail on it. But so, you know, the main the main bodies that we think about are copyright, patent, trade secret, and trademark. And I guess I'll just say one word on the trademark. We were talking about that a little bit in our discussions prior. Trademarks, obviously, there's huge value in associating, you know, the mark with the good or service to differentiate yourself and identify yourself. And I think of it kind of like a chicken or an egg thing. Like if we were talking about the Google trademark and how powerful that is, but you know, is it powerful because they had a great search engine and everyone liked it, or is it powerful because it was just a cool name and people went there and they're like, oh, this search thing's really cool too, you know? So the purpose here, or the what I was intending to cover, is you know, these kind of core things that are the things that the businesses are built on, and in my mind, the trademark is somewhat ancillary in that way, which is why I have it differentiated. I just have this real quick table. I will not spend a lot of time on this, but down the far left column, we've got, just to help differentiate the different kinds of IP, we've got the subject matter, right? Criteria for protection, what's eligible for how do you get protection? How do you actually secure that? And then what do those rights allow you to do? And then some common examples. And so we've been, the title of this is The Life Cycle of an Idea, but it's important to recognize on this first top row here, it's not really ideas that are protected. So the subject matter, for instance, on copyrights are actual expressions, as distinguished from patents are, you know, what can be protected by a patent is, you know, an apparatus, a process, a composition. So it's not merely the idea. And then trade secrets, different as well. So I just want to highlight that at first. And then, so for copyrights, you know, well, what does the expression have to be? It has to be original and creative for you to get rights in it as its author. And how do you get the rights? You have to fix it in a tangible medium of expression. You have to write it down or, you know, put it on your computer screen, or paint a picture or sculpt, right? So you have to actually fix that that expression. And what does it allow you to do? Once you do that, it gives you the exclusive right to copy it, make derivative works of it, distribute it. And then the examples, you know, we've got songs and source code, software code, right? For patents, it's not just the expression, it's an actual apparatus, a process, or composition that's eligible for protection. And it's different. What are the criteria? It's a little bit different. It actually has to be useful and new and non-obvious. How do you obtain rights? You don't merely fix it in a tangible medium of expression. You actually have to go to the government and say, here's my application. And then the government goes through a process and gives you a patent at the end of that process, you know, assuming you meet all those criteria. What does it allow you to do? It allows you to exclude others from making, using, selling, importing. And that's different from the copyright. And, you know, examples are as simple as, you know, the coffee sleeve. If you look at the coffee sleeve on your cup of coffee, there's actually like a patent number on there, and you know, one click shopping cart just to kind of hit the other end of the spectrum. Trade secrets are different than copyrights and patents. So the subject matter there is, you know, information, processes, formulas, etc. And how do you get those rights? Well, you have to keep them secret. The criteria is it has to be secret, and to obtain rights, you actually have to expend resources to keep it secret. That's what gives you the right in it. And what does it allow you to do? It allows you to have a leg up against your competition who doesn't know that secret, the secret way of doing things. And the prototypical example there is the Coca-Cola formula. That's the, you know, textbook example of that. So I know that, you know, you can have a whole course in, you know, what the different kinds of IP are and what all these criteria are and how you get rights, but I just wanted to make the main point that there are different kinds of IP. There's different subject matter and different criteria. And then I thought what we would do is just spend a little time talking about, and we can address the question about the soft IP, about, you know, what types of IP do you guys value? I think my guess is what David, you know, from the point of view of let's take the resource question. You know, what might an early stage company, some type of IP they can kind of protect and value versus, you know, the big corporation who's got a patent department?
Well, so and this, I think, will address your question as well. A lot of the IP lawyers hate this, but we use provisional patents very aggressively. Provisional patents are a lot less expensive to get together, but we didn't do it necessarily for the cost. We did it because it's a great way. It's one thing if you're going to do an invention by yourself and try to patent it. You know, you can sit there and work on it. But most of the time, the patents are done by multiple people. And what the provisional process allows us to do is get everybody to put their information in quickly and work on it in a group and at least get the process going and get some level of protection as we work down the path. So we actually use it more in the early stage as a way to get the teams working to get the IP done, with the huge side benefit that it's a lot cheaper. I've had IP attorneys tell me, oh, they have no value at all, and I don't know why you do them. Let's just go right to the patent. And from patent prosecution, that may be true. But from an entrepreneur standpoint and from organizing your team and getting processes in place, I think it's a great management tool to get things going. And it does give you some level of dollars and protection. So I would say, would you say less than $5,000?
Yeah, I just paid $2,000 to $3,000.
$2,000 to $3,000. So, but again, that's before you've done the discussion with the lawyer of I have no cash.
But, you know, and I also want to say too that, and I think this was to the point, is there's a lot that's out on the internet right now. I mean, if you can talk to a good IP lawyer, they can work with you and you can do a lot of that legwork yourself. Yep. So, I mean, some of the first patents that I ever actually got awarded, I wrote all the provisionals and I'm not even a very good writer, so I mean, if I can do it.
Yeah, that's actually the important point is you don't actually have to. You can do a lot of that work without having to pay lawyer
fees. It's a good process to learn anyway, I think. I mean, if you're into protecting your IP that way.
By the way, there's also a startup in India that will go in and do that search for you, you know, at, you know, one-fifth the price that you would pay for it here. I don't recall the name, but if you're interested, come by and I'll give you a way to find it.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I'm not hopefully being liable for saying this, but I mean, Google patents and some of the tools that are coming out right now are pretty impressive. You know, I was doing this, you know, 5-6 years ago, and I didn't have those types of tools. And, you know, I was looking at some concepts, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, and I just sat down on a Saturday and I was able to read through 200 patents right there with Google. So, I mean, you know, that information is readily available, you know, to all of us.
The other one I'll say is trademarks, I think, are really, really important. And I think, you know, when we first did it, we thought trademarks were important from a defensive position to protect ourselves. But at my last company, I was surprised that large corporations sometimes don't do a very good job of checking trademarks. And we had a situation where a very large corporation actually came out and announced their product with almost the same exact name as ours. And we had the trademark. And it turned out to be by accident, an offensive play where they came and actually worked with us. And it was very beneficial. So I think, you know, people run out and get domains like crazy. Why would you not do the same thing with trademarks? It's not that much harder and it's not very expensive. And, you know, you're just smart to protect everything around it. You know, build a little moat of the things that you may even use is important. There are strict rules, unlike the domains, of how you do the trademarks, but most of them are pretty easy to follow. That was what we learned.
Yeah, I agree with Dave. And one thing I just want to caution you on as the typical lawyer up here, just because you get a domain name doesn't mean you have the trademark rights in it. It's a mistake that's oftentimes made by entrepreneurs. And as the gentleman who asked the question before we got into the various types of IP pointed out, use the internet to do your initial legwork. It'll save you a lot of legal fees. You can go on to Google, type in the name of the trademark you want to search, go on to the patent and trademark office sites, do search. Although those aren't updated in real time, it'll still give you a pretty good idea and help you knock something out right away or go to the next level and decide to incur some of those legal fees that you may have to incur.
Let me ask you guys, especially, you know, Wade, you've invested in companies in different industries, and, you know, David, obviously, you know, Motion was in tablets, and now you're in the Web 2.0 space. Is there any different mindset in terms of what you as an investor and entrepreneur, you know, with a view to the future, value, whether it be patents, you know, does the industry matter?
I think it does. I think in the biotech industry, it seems to matter a great deal more. Even within the software industry, depending on the nature of the software and the type, I think it I think there's a difference.
Yeah, I think the difference you have to watch for is, I think it's very simple to look at. It's what are the types of people that are in your space, and how fast is the industry moving? So on hardware, there were not a lot of small entrepreneurs doing a lot of rapid development. I mean, we were doing a tablet PC, which was based on PC technology. Most of the IP was being done by large corporations, very easy to figure out what was going on in the Web 2.0 space and in the biotech space. Incredibly fast, small teams of entrepreneurs and inventors doing stuff. And so trying to figure out whether you're ahead or not is a lot harder, I think, on the software space. And so, you know, one of the things I would also say is, if you're going to go get an IP attorney to help you, or if you're going to do the research, make sure you're looking in the right place. Having an IP attorney that specializes in oil and gas when you're doing Web 2.0 isn't very smart. And it may sound funny, but actually that happens. Yep. And you really want to make sure that you're dealing with IP counsel or IP advisors that actually understand those two pieces of the equation.
I'm a little confused. The cost for filing a provisional patent with the patent office is $200. I assume you mean it's $2,000 or $3,000 if you get a lawyer involved.
Exactly.
But as an individual, not even a company, you can pay as little as $100 and file a provisional patent and write the provisional patent yourself and have protection for up to a year. So if you don't get an IP attorney involved, it's not $2,000 or $3,000.
That's right.
Good. Thank you. Yeah.
Are there any other questions? We're coming towards the end of the time. Come on up.
Howdy. So how have you found it to be? So, you know, there's a lot of circumstances in which you kind of want to give away stuff, either put stuff out under open source licenses or just kind of in the new Web 2.0 world where you're always blogging about your, you know, stellar new ideas. What protection do you really need, and especially for the, CEOs in the audience? How do you know when to kind of listen to your attorneys and advisors and when to ignore them? Because, I mean, just from working with our in-house counsel, the obvious lawyer recommendation is always, you know, don't say nothing ever unless you've got a 10-page contract.
Good question.
Do you want to go first?
Go ahead.
Okay, so my approach to dealing with the lawyers, and both of these guys have been attorneys for me, is thank you very much. I understand why you said no. I'm going to do it. Now how do I keep from getting sued? Seriously, that's what you have to do. And you say, this is the business case. And actually, if you have a good lawyer, they'll actually figure out how to do that. I'm not poo-pooing what you say because I hear that a lot. And they'll give me the laundry list of 35 reasons why you should never do this. And you say, thank you very much. I really have to do this. It's important for my business. Don't tell me no. Tell me how to do it. That's my number one piece of advice. The second thing is you got this balance you got to worry. It's really, I think, a bigger issue on the web of the indemnifications and the licenses are getting so large. But you're giving pieces of code away and the license terms are longer than, you know, the code that's being given away. And I think that's going to be an interesting issue over time, because how many people really read those things is something that's got to be worked out. So, but again, I could never write that. So the early discussion about costs, that's something I would never even try to do. I think that's another place where lawyers can help you a lot. And, you know, they have a responsibility to their clients to make sure they raise those issues. And, you know, you've got to just work through that. It's been my experience.
And that's where it helps if the attorneys you're working with are in that space too. I mean, they can, you know, and if you trust that they're in that space, you're going to get some pretty good advice from them. But, you know, coming from a son of an attorney and, you know, maybe three generations back, I'm used to, they seem to always work with the worst case scenario. And so as an entrepreneur, you just kind of have to say, you know, take their feedback, understand where they're coming from, and then you make a business decision on it.
Have a big company question. Matt mentioned the prior disclosure sort of addendum as part of the draconian agreement. we're in a position in which, for reasons of employee retention and employee satisfaction, people are coming up with ideas that technically the company owns, but we have no interest in pursuing or productizing. Is there a process that people ordinarily do for, as a company, say, yes, we own this idea, but you came up with it, we're not interested in this, go ahead and go for it. You know, we give you all the rights back.
Yeah, we actually haven't come up with that issue yet, fortunately, but I think there are ways of addressing it, and it's really getting your in-house counsel and the executive team together and coming up with a process where the individuals can come to this group of people, say, this is the idea I've come up with. My understanding from my manager or whoever you've talked to up the chain has indicated that the company has decided not to pursue this. How can I obtain my rights back? They can license it back to you. They could, you know, sell it back to you. Do very simple things so you can then pursue that on your own time.
And the other thing about that is there are formal corporate transactions that, I mean, obviously involve transaction costs and executive time and everything else. But, you know, if there's someone that's come up with this great idea and they're really passionate about it and everything else, and it's just not the direction of the company, you sometimes see a spinoff, right? So the company owns a stake in the new company. So all the stockholders of the old company own part of the new company. Then the founder of the new company, who's the employee that's leaving, you know, goes, there's a transfer of IP, and, you know, those deals can be set up. So if it's really something that people are serious about, you know, that then it benefits all the shareholders. I'm sure a company doesn't want to do that with, you know, all of its employees all the time, because then they wouldn't have any left. But those are things that can be explored.
We just have about 5 minutes left, by the way, so we'll take your questions. And if you guys have any questions, you can come up, I'm sure, and talk to any of us after the panel.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about selecting the right type of IP for your business. I'm in the e-commerce space, and all of our customers are, you know, individuals. So we're more worried about business process protection from competitors. And I'm wondering, can you elaborate on how to pick the right types of IP to protect business process?
Sure, I'll try. It definitely depends on each business. Given your example of where you are, my guess is copyrights, trade secrets, and trademarks as you're marketing to an individual. So if you have a strong brand to get out in front of everybody, those are the type of protections you're going to want in place. And given that, it's of utmost importance for a company like yours to have the proprietary information agreement signed by your employee base. And then to the extent you can protect your rights, so if somebody's using your trademark to pursue them through a cease and desist or what have you, and those are pretty easy forms. The problem today, as the internet continues to grow, is policing that, which is an obligation of a trademark holder. If you're aware of it, you need to act upon it. So it's a tough situation.
The trick that I found to do this quickly is go look on the sites for the industry association events, and frequently the attorneys or the firms that specialize will be there. And then you can actually call them and find out if they're not the right, they'll tell you. But the way I found Wilson Sonsini when I started Motion, even though they were in town here, was I went to a garage.com developer event for startups in the West Coast, and they were one of the underwriters. And I talked to them and they said, oh, we have an Austin practice that specializes in exactly what you're doing. And that kind of was the trick of, hey, you can go look at those sites. The attorneys tend to advertise in the areas they practice. So that may be a quick way to find.
Just a quick follow-up. In terms of a competitor copying business process, prior to protection, is there any recourse? Is documentation a recourse, or is it just you need some sort of protection?
So if you've written out your business process, for example, you'd hold the copyright in it. So there are protections available to you. For example, again, with a copyright, the minute you put it into a paper, for example, you own the copyright. You don't have to go to the copyright office and get a registered copyright, although that does give you added benefits in the event you're suing somebody.
Thank you.
I think I have a quick question. I'd love to hear your comments on recent trends related to like Creative Commons, I guess more towards creative work. My understanding is it's not really a recognized form of protection, but yet people seem to be using it a lot regardless of that. But I'd love to hear your comments about that and maybe the any future trends that you see?
I'll say a word about that. So you're getting an open source type of stuff. That goes beyond, you know, kind of who that's a means of protection that the person who is the author in that case has, you know, they have the copyright for that code, right? And then they can decide what they want to do with it, right? So they can go copyright it and proprietary license for money, or they can kind of copyright it on open source terms.
Or it could be, I've seen on several sites where it's, you know, either an image or something that somebody has written, you know, so creative work and not necessarily a product form. But.
Right. So I guess the bottom line is that that those concepts of the, you know, being open or whatever, there's still a copyrightable protected interest, and then the terms under which the person can use, you know, you give something up when you put it out into the community, and then, but if you want to use it from the community, you take it subject to certain terms. It doesn't speak to, you know, the actual ownership. It's the rights and restrictions you have in that work. So it's just and I think the important thing is to set up the right processes. So you say, okay, if I'm taking this under these terms, can I do with what I want? Can I do with it what I want? For instance, if you take something under the GPL, you know, then you're going to have an obligation to make, you know, a derivative work available, right, to the community. And if your business model is to charge for that software, then that's going to be a problem. So it's just a matter of, as cumbersome as the process can be, I think, you know, following those, you know, understanding what you're agreeing to when you take that stuff. Yeah. Well, thanks all for coming, and I think we'll be around here for a little while if anyone has any further questions.